welcome to session number 365, the only one that I could actually remember that I was chairing. This is Chiastic Sexual Patterns of the Story of Sodom and Gomorrah and the Question of Literal Interpretation. Our speaker today is Claire Barris, and just a few words about him. Claire has presented papers at Sunstone and the Mormon History Association. He manages Today in Mormon History and blogs at WithoutEnd.org and Mormon Chronicles. He is a senior systems engineer at a large company in the Utah Valley. He also enjoys Mormon history and has presented papers at Sunstone and MHA on a number of topics. He manages the site Today in Mormon History. Claire believes that more can be done to help the church to be more welcoming of gay Mormon community, and he has written about the history of the church and homosexuality since 1993, well before his time, as well as testifying before Utah legislature regarding equal housing and employment rights for gay Utahns. Truly will be a pleasure to hear from him today. So just a few words about the session. We ask that you silence your cell phones. We don't want to be distracted by those. We also ask that if you have a chance to go to the first floor and take a look at the book sales room, a portion of those proceeds does benefit Sunstone, and we all want for this great organization to move forward. This session is being recorded, so be aware of that. We also ask at the end, when it's time for questions, that you come to the microphone and speak into it so that those questions can be recorded as well as the answer that's given. All right, let's hear from Claire.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay? Is that good? All right, I just got to warn you. This is a dicey session, so I'm going to talk about incest, prostitution, impotence, rape, menopause, virginity, voyeurism, dismemberment, and sex with angels. So there are some pictures. I'm just warning you. If you want to leave, now's your chance. However, it's all in the scriptures, so it's okay.
I don't care about the pictures. I can't see them anyhow.
All right.
Somebody will tell you.
You'll get the idea. Okay. And this all started when I was asked to substitute a gospel doctrine lesson a few years ago. In fact, in the past 12 years, I've been asked to substitute teach two times. Both of them were the Sodom and Gomorrah story.
Nobody
so it's divine providence or something, I don't know.
Yeah.
I discovered unexpected parallels between Sodom and Gomorrah story and some of the stories preceding it. And upon further examination, I came to the realization that the story was specifically constructed in a way to parallel two earlier stories. I'll discuss how these stories fed into the Sodom and Gomorrah story and how a later story borrowed from that story and reshaped it even further. All of the stories have to do with sex. The Old Testament can be very frank about sexuality and does not shy away from discussing a wide variety of sexuality. And as I've read through these stories, I've concluded that the authors were determined not to repeat any previously discussed form of sexuality, but instead add new twists based on older stories. My original intent was not to explore sexuality at all. However, I realized how integral it is to these stories. All the stories I'll talk about talk of improbable, unproductive, or inappropriate sexuality in order to demonstrate the superiority of Israel over its enemies. And that's important to remember. That's what all of this is about. The cities of Sodom and Gomorrah are introduced in Genesis 13 when Lot chooses the fertile Eden-like land surrounding Sodom and Gomorrah near the edge of the land of promise, promised to Abraham. Abraham and his nephew Lot are running out of room for their livestock, and he allows Lot to choose from where he would like to migrate. The proximity of Lot's choice near the nations of Moab and Ammon are important to the story. By the end of the story, the garden-like area, this was all Eden-like here. Now it's a sea full of salt and desert. By the story's end, the garden-like area will be desolate, and an unsavory tale of unholy conception, and yes, I mean literal conception, of Israel's enemies will be contrasted with the miraculous conception of Isaac, future father of Israel. The The Sodom story was borrowed from an earlier story, while a later one borrows from it. Each story goes out of its way to discuss different forms of sexual relationship while marring the character of the author's enemies. Sodom and Gomorrah are next mentioned in the context of battles and alliances between the kings of cities. Nine kings are mentioned. Seven of those names appear to be authentic, fitting the context of time and place, but two names appear to be allegorical in nature rather than actual names. The king of Sodom's name is Bera, meaning in evil. The king of Gomorrah's name is Bersha, meaning in wickedness. The names appear to be constructed to make sure the reader knew who the bad guys were, to metaphorically represent evil and wickedness, foreshadowing the coming story. This is an early indication of the figurative nature of the Sodom and Gomorrah story. Lot, now residing in Sodom, is captured in battle, and Abraham must rescue Lot. When Lot is rescued, an important contrast to the names of the participants occurs. Abraham meets with Melchizedek, the king of Salem, Salem meaning peace, like Shalom, Salem, and the king Bera of Sodom. The name Melchizedek means approximately, my king is righteous, or king of righteousness. He accepts an offering from Abraham, while Abraham refuses an offering from the king of Sodom, or the king of evil. This purposeful construction of the allegorical king in evil and his ally, king in wickedness, stands in contrast to the king of righteousness, king of peace. Hospitality. The first parts of chapters 18 and 19 provide contrasting parallels exploring Middle Eastern hospitality. And I should mention, hospitality is a huge deal among Middle Eastern culture. And if you were not a good host, it was about the worst thing you could do. So it was very important for them to do. The parallels show Abraham, the future father of Israel, as an excellent host, with Lot, the future father of Ammon and Moab, as a good host, but falling short. Foreshadowing events to come. Note these important contrasts, and I've underlined items that are particularly important. So you notice in the Abraham story on the left, there are three heavenly beings, while Lot has two heavenly beings to visit. Abraham runs and bows to the visitors. Lot rises, and he rises. Abraham's invitation to wash, eat, and rest are accepted. Lot's invitation is reluctantly accepted. The feast is prepared. Bread, tender calf, butter, and milk are mentioned in Abraham's story, but in Lot's story, only unleavened bread is mentioned. So there's a little bit of, Lot doesn't quite measure up. Abraham's hospitality exceeds that of Lot's, and the visitors are more receptive to Abraham. Lot is not graced with a visit from the Lord, who is one of the three visitors. After each of the meals, the issue of improbable, inappropriate, or unproductive sexual union and divine intervention is explored. The Sodom story is carefully constructed to parallel the Abraham-Sarah story. A careful construction of parallels between the stories is apparent. Let's go through those very quickly. So with Abraham and Sarah, we have a divine visitor asks, where is Sarah? But with Lot, the evil people ask, where are the divine visitors? With Abraham, the visitors will soon see Sarah with a son from a sexual union. In Sodom, the evil people want to have sex with the visitors. Sarah hears from the door while Lot comes out through the door. Sarah is barren due to age, i.e. menopause, and Lot pleads, don't be wicked. Sarah laughs, which is the Hebrew word for Isaac, at the suggestion of having sexual pleasure from the feeble or impotent Abraham. Lot offers his virgin daughters to the men for their sexual pleasure to spare his guests. The Lord wonders why Sarah questions him but will bless her union anyway, while the evil men question Lot's judgment, so they will do worse to Lot than the intended rape of his visitors. And then the miracle of a sexual union is not too hard for the Lord, and a son will be produced. While in the Sodom story, Lot's household is saved from sexual union with the evil men through a miraculous means by the visitors. In the Sodom story, a series of unproductive, unwanted sexual propositions are explored. The angels, Lot's virgin daughters, and finally Lot are each the object of potential unwanted sexual union or rape by the people of Sodom. This is contrasted with Abraham and Sarah's wanted sexual union. Just as with Sarah, Lot's daughters later will have a productive sexual union and become the mother of nations. God is contrasted with the inhabitants of Sodom, who symbolize evil. Both want a sexual union to occur, but have opposing motives. The goodness of God providing a miraculous union to a reluctant couple is contrasted with the potential unwanted rape of angels, young women, and a man by a city ruled over by a king named In Evil. In both stories, divine intervention is employed to cause or prevent sexual union. Abraham and Sarah will have a productive sexual union, while the intents of the inhabitants of Sodom are thwarted. Both stories revolve around a door, with the location of the players inverted across the stories. And I should mention, you mentioned I should explain what chiastic structure is, and it's really about parallels. And not all of these parallels that I'm discussing are chiastic, but in Greek there's the letter chi, which is like an X, and it shows that there are patterns that kind of invert in and then invert out, and oftentimes the very center of that sandwich is kind of like a sandwich where you've got bread and then you've got some lettuce and some mayo, and then you've got and then you have the meat in the middle. And so that's what a chiastic structure. These are both chiastic structures and other parallels. And the Hebrews loved to do parallels. And sometimes they're reinforcing each other, and sometimes they're contrasting each other. But by understanding the parallels and recognizing them, you can see what the author is trying to do. And it's so important in reading the Old Testament in particular to notice these and understand the parallels that are going on. So Sarah stays inside the tent door where the sexual union will take place, while the visitors remain outside. In Sodom, the sexual activity is to take place outside the door. The visitors, Lot's daughters, and Lot are protected from sexual activity behind the door. Also contrasted here is Sarah's state of menopause, or post-childbearing, to Lot's virgin daughters, pre-childbearing. Lot's daughters are virgins, even though they appear to be married. And this is not all interpreters agree with it. Some say there may have been some other daughters that aren't mentioned. But as I read it, there appear to be the two daughters that are mentioned. And I'm going to go with that interpretation. But there is another interpretation there, where there could be additional daughters. Lot's daughters are virgin, even though they appear to be married, providing yet another twist in the author's attempt to describe nearly every kind of sexuality but that of a fertile married couple having intimate relations that produce children. Just as Sarah and Abraham are not having sex, neither are Lot's daughters having sex with their husbands. Abraham, of course, goes on to bear a son, which fathers the nation of Israel, while Lot ends up fleeing Sodom and fathering Israel's enemies. It is important for the storyline that Lot's wife dies and his sons-in-law and sons remain behind in order to add yet another twist on sexuality that insults the Moabites and Ammonites. The story of her turning into a pillar of salt is used to provide an explanation of the common salt formations that occur naturally around the Dead Sea. Lot is left with just his daughters, with whom, in parallel to Abraham, he will father a nation. And if you Google salt pillars, Dead Sea, there's a lot of really beautiful pictures of salt pillars of salt. Living alone in a cave, the two daughters get Lot drunk and have sex with him in order to perpetuate their seed. The two sons are named Moab, and the author here, they make a wordplay on it, and I don't think that was the original intent, but the author of the story, Moab means of the same father, which is implies incest, and Ben-Ami, which can be interpreted as son of my paternal kin. An apparent attempt by the author to imply that the nations of Moab and Ammon were conceived through incest, while Israel was conceived through God's miraculous intervention. The Sodom and Gomorrah story was carefully written to parallel the story of the Lord telling Abraham and Sarah that despite their age, they would be able to conceive a child. The thwarted sexual intents of the people of Sodom paralleled the discussion of Abraham and Sarah's inability to conceive. But God intervenes in both stories by promising Abraham and Sarah a child and preventing the people of Sodom from carrying out their intents. Now this goes on to another section. The Sodom and Gomorrah story was also influenced by the older story of Noah and the flood. The story of Noah begins with these curious verses. The divine being saw how beautiful the daughters of men were and took wives from among those that pleased them. It was then and later too that the Nephilim appeared on the earth when the divine beings cohabited with the daughters of men who bore them offspring. They were the heroes of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw how great was man's wickedness on the earth. The Lord wanted to destroy all of humanity, but sees that one man, Noah, is righteous. So he provides a method for Noah to survive and his family to survive the pending destruction. After the flood, Noah plants a vineyard, makes wine, gets drunk, and naked. It's quite a celebration. Sexual impropriety occurs as Ham views his nude father, resulting in Ham's son Canaan and his descendants being cursed. These Canaanites were also the avowed enemies of Israel. Consider these following parallels between the story of Noah and of Sodom and Gomorrah. So I'll bounce back and forth between these two. The first section is kind of a summary, but let me go to the second one. Angels have sexual relations with the daughters of men. The inhabitants of Sodom and Gomorrah want to have sexual relations with angels. No righteous found in all the world. The Lord wants to destroy all of humanity. No righteous is found in Sodom. The Lord wants to destroy it. One righteous person is found, Noah and his family. One righteous person is found, Lot and his family. Noah saved by following God's directions to build an ark. Lot saved from destruction by following the divine being's directions to leave the city. Noah is drunk and naked. Ham is sexually inappropriate when seeing Noah, resulting in Ham's son fathering the cursed Canaanites, enemies of Israel. Lot's daughters get him drunk and have sexual relations with him, resulting in his daughters mothering the nations of Moab and Ammon, the enemies of Israel. So hopefully this set of parallels is pretty obvious. Heavenly beings are drawn to and have sexual relations with human women producing offspring, possibly including the race of Nephilim, which means ones who have fallen. This may have been part of the corruption that needed to be wiped out by the flood. The author of Sodom and Gomorrah story borrows this episode but inverts the players, with humans wanting to have sexual relations with heavenly beings. Because of the evil intent such as this, Sodom is to be destroyed. It is unclear what sort of sexual encounter occurs when Ham saw his drunken, unaware father. The story is also borrowed by the author of the Sodom story, but with Lot's daughters having sexual encounters with their drunken father, who was also unaware of what had transpired. The inappropriate sexuality occurring in both stories results in nations of people that are defined as less than that of Israel. Noah's grandson produces the Canaanites that inhabit the land of Israel, and Lot's grandsons produce the Moabites and Ammonites, which inhabit the area east of Israel. These three nations were the avowed enemies of Israel. Both stories begin and end with sexual encounters. Each begins with sexual attraction or union of humans and angels. Each story ends with incestuous attraction or relations. And this is a real good chiastic structure, and very interesting to study this. The author of the Sodom story took measures to ensure that that a set of parallels and contrasts occurred in relation to the older and sparser Noah story. Each story is framed with an instance of homosexual attraction and heterosexual relations. The author of the Sodom story inverts the sexual orientation of those in the Noah story. The beginning episodes have the object of desire inverted, and the ending stories have the genders of the initiators inverted. Also, in a contrasting relationship is that of angels and humans to children and fathers, incest, which has the same comparative relation as gender and orientation. Apparently, for variety's sakes, the author ensures that the types of encounters and numbers involved in the four encounters are unique. This pattern continues in a later story in Judges, which carefully parallels the Sodom and Gomorrah story. After flooding the earth to rid it of evil, God promises never to destroy it again, but evil finds its way back. The destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah represent a retelling of the flood story, but on a smaller scale. The unflattering, incestuous episodes at the end of both stories tell a story of the nearly immediate reintroduction of evil after God's cleansing. However, the new evil now resides in Israel's neighboring enemies, passed on to their posterity. Israel now has a license to define the Canaanites, Moabites, and Ammonites as other, unchosen and cursed. And they have license to do things like genocide and so forth because of stories like this that justify this. One might assume that the borrowing of stories and parallels having to do with Sodom and Gomorrah stopped there, but the story was a major influence on a later, rather gruesome story of sex and violence and even dismemberment. This story borrows from the Sodom story as a template, using sexuality to shame a group of people. The story is in Judges 19 and tells of a Levite, his unfaithful concubine, and their unfortunate stay in the Benjamite city. The story follows the motif of the two earlier stories of the visitors hosted by Abraham and Sarah, and then hosted by Lot and Sodom. Touched on are the same themes of hospitality, travelers receiving shelter from a foreigner, bargaining over sexuality through a door, marring or exalting the character of a group of people, and the near total destruction of a group of people. In Sodom, the rape of angels, Lot's daughters, and Lot are averted. But in the Canaanite concubine story, the author took the Sodom story further and had the rape actually occur. In addition, the victim is dismembered, not by the rapist, but by her husband. And her body parts are used to incite Israel to destroy nearly all of the tribes of the rapists. All of the tribe of the rapists. The author of this story follows the earlier established pattern and demonizes the Benjamites making them appear as bad as the inhabitants of Sodom, and then justifying their near annihilation. Consider these parallels to the Sodom story. We have until a quarter after, is that right?
We do.
We got plenty of time. Okay, let me go through this real fast. The Levite, I'll just kind of go on the left and you can read on the right and see the parallels. The Levite, an unfaithful, whoring concubine, is hosted for 5 days by her father. The couple travel to a courtyard in the city of Benjamin where no one takes them in except an old man who is also a foreigner to the city. The men of the city beat at the door. They want sexual relations with the visiting men. The old man pleads to the people, "Do not do so wickedly," to his guests. And note, this is an almost exact quote from the Sodom story. There are several nearly exact quotes which indicate a borrowing, a further indicate a borrowing from that story. The old man offers his maiden daughters and his concubine, "Do with them what seemeth good to you." The men reject the old man's offer to the guests. And the guests offer his concubines, and they, quote, "knew her and abused her all the night until the morning," close quote. The concubine crawls to the doorstop and dies. The husband cuts her into 12 pieces, which he sends throughout Israel. They realize there is no such deed done nor seen from the days that the children of Israel came out of the land of Egypt. War is then declared on the Benjamites, where they are nearly destroyed. And then virgins are provided to the Benjamites to repopulate the tribe. In the four stories, Sarah and Abraham are the only partners both willing to engage in sex, but are unable to consummate a union without divine intervention. In Sodom, divine intervention prevents sexual union. In the Noah story, details of any sexual encounter beyond voyeurism are omitted. It appears that the human women were willing partners with divine beings because the term wives implies marriage. In the Levite concubine story,
marriage does not imply consent, and that's crucial.
Oh. Okay, thank you. And you know, I've kind of wondered what actually that might mean, and I kind of actually think that the wives were not, it may not have been consensual.
Yeah.
Especially when you line up the chiastic parallel.
Yeah.
It violates the chiasm. So thanks for bringing that up. I appreciate
that's
it.
That's why marital rape is now a thing. And it never used to be. But marriage in no way necessarily implies consent, especially when women are treated as objects.
Okay, yeah, and that actually chiasm backs that up.
Yep.
So, and I wrestled with whether or not to include that sense. Maybe I shouldn't have. Thank you. All right. In the Levite concubine story, a departure in the established pattern occurs when unwanted sexual union actually occurs and the men rape the concubine. Early on, a foreshadowing of Abraham facing God and shunning evil occurs in Hebrew wordplays in Genesis 14 when the names of the kings of Sodom, Gomorrah, and Salem are employed, contrasting evil and wickedness to righteousness and peace. Abraham faces King Melchizedek, the king of Salem, while turning his back on Bera, the king of Sodom. The chiastic template is initiated in the Noah story that will also be used in the Sodom story. The same template is used for the Sodom story. Inserted into this framework, however, is the contrasting parallel to the story of Abraham, Sarah, and the visitors. Both Abraham and Sarah's inability to be a sexual partner or conceive contrasts with Lot's daughters, and then Lot nearly being sexual partners with the people of Sodom. God intervenes in both parties, promising to restore virility to Abraham and fertility to Sarah, while preventing the inhabitants of Sodom from exercising their desire. The obvious careful constructed parallels between these two stories indicate that aspects of the Sodom and Gomorrah story were borrowed from the earlier episodes of the story of Noah. The story of Sodom should not be read literally, but metaphorically. Understanding the author's use of literary methods brings a deeper understanding to the story. Using these stories to define classes of people as cursed or evil continues into our own day. For example, the Noah, Ham, Canaan story has been used by religious people to justify slavery or classifying blacks as other or cursed, and therefore exploitable or unworthy of equal treatment. Fortunately, this is on the decline. The Sodom and Gomorrah story stands out at the heart of anti-homosexual biblical teachings, even though homosexuality is not the theme of the Sodom story. This proof-texted argument comes by focusing on a few items taken out of context or misunderstood. Part of the argument requires that only the men of Sodom are involved in the attempted rape. Verse 4 notes, however, the men of the city, even the men of Sodom, both old and young, they were the ones who gathered at Lot's house. However, the verse goes on to elaborate that this included all the people from every quarter of the city. The patriarchal bias of the time and of the author mentions women only when necessary for the storyline. And note that, for example, Lot's daughters, there's no names for them, nor Noah's wife, or anybody. I mean, it's obviously extremely patriarchal. Uncareful readers assume the visitors who were to be raped are men, but reading the rest of the chapter indicates that they are angels. When the people of the city refused Lot's daughters as surrogate targets of rape, some assume it is because of a lack of heterosexual desire. The story is about hospitality, paralleling the preceding chapter about Abraham's hospitality. Lot's extreme offer of hospitality to his visitors by offering his daughters must be rejected by the people of Sodom, allowing the story to illustrate that Sodom is completely evil. The chiastic structure set up in chapter 18, the preceding chapter, requires Lot and his daughters to follow the contrasting template set up in the Abraham and Sarah story. Just as Abraham and Sarah are unable to have sex, but will soon have sex and produce a son, neither can Lot and his daughters have sex with the people of Sodom. But later in the story, he and his daughters will go on to have sex and produce sons. The chiastic structure requires God to intervene and demonstrate power over evil. With Abraham and Sarah, he restores desired sexuality, while in the Sodom story, he prevents unwanted sex from occurring. God is more powerful than Sodom, Era, or evil, and Gomorrah, Bersha, or wickedness, and thwarts evil's intent to have unwanted sex, which includes the virgin daughters. Later biblical writers did not see homosexuality as the theme of the Sodom story. None of the 27 references to the Sodom and Gomorrah story beyond Genesis refer to homosexuality. Today, some distort the meaning and intent of the Sodom and Gomorrah story. The reading is based on a tradition of preconceived notions and a misunderstanding of the text. The story should be read for what it is, with an understanding of the culture within the context of the other related stories in Genesis. Thank you.
Really great. I went to a Mormon Stories conference in Washington, D.C. about 2 years ago, and Carolyn Pearson was just insistent that the Sodom and Gomorrah story was more about bad hospitality than anything else, so it's really good to hear that echoed again here. We have until 4:45 for questions, so please, let's have an active and engaged discussion. Please answer or ask the questions that you have in your hearts and in your minds, and let's just keep this discussion going.
First of all, just great presentation, and it had never occurred to me to parallel the Noah and Lot stories before, and the way you presented it is very compelling and fascinating. The question that I had for you is, first of all, are you saying that ancient readers or hearers of the Sodom and Gomorrah story would have understood this as an anti-homosexual or a story about the immorality of same-sex sexual relations?
Well, I'm two things on that.
One, yeah, and before you answer, because the reason I ask is because modern exegetical work on this almost universally rejects it as an anti-homosexual story. Even among conservative Christians now, pretty much there is universal agreement that this story isn't about homosexuality. So I'm curious, because it sounded to me like you're suggesting maybe for ancients this was a narrative about homosexuality.
No, I probably wasn't clear. I don't think the author intended that. I think the author uses a variety of sexual, chiastic inversions of heterosexuality and homosexuality to frame a larger story, and the larger story is the intent. I think the homosexuality, as I understand it, and I haven't researched this, but I believe that idea got introduced sometime in the Middle Ages, and then it kind of has flourished since then. And other biblical authors who have gone back to the story of Sodom and Gomorrah have not interpreted it as a homosexual text. So I don't think that was the intent. It's certainly not the primary text at all. And some may have interpreted it that way, but I don't think they understood what the author was trying to get at.
Yeah, okay. And sort of a related sub-question, and I'll step down, because there is that interesting reference in Jude to going after strange flesh. And I don't know if you wanted to comment on that.
Yeah, and I think it was Cheryl who's back there. She wrote a blog post on this, and if I remember right, she kind of points out that is the, as time goes on, and you have later and later and later quotes, it kind of moves more towards that. It's still not explicitly about homosexuality, but it is, I think, the latest of all the biblical texts.
Right, it is.
So it kind of shows an evolution of thought towards that, perhaps. Yeah.
Hi, I'm wondering, you mentioned that the story can be misinterpreted to be about the negativity of homosexuality, even though it's not. So I'm wondering if you think that most, if not all, stories have been misinterpreted in some way or another.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of, in the Bible, you mean a lot of, yeah, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding, and I think it's really important to get good commentaries to try to understand it. And you can really, a good commentary, a good author can really help illuminate a text for what it really is. So I think that's important to do. But yeah, I think there's a lot of misinterpretation.
So this is a text that we spent a lot of time on when I took the Old Testament as literature many years ago, and I want to read what verse 2 actually says. And his concubine played the whore against him and went away from him unto her father's house. To play the whore didn't necessarily mean to have sex with someone other than one's husband. It meant not to be subjected to the husband's oversight. So it is very possible that she was utterly faithful.
And let me point out before you move on from that, and this is in Judges 19.
Yeah.
And this, if you read the LXX,
Septuagint,
which is a Greek version of the Hebrew Bible, that is missing from there.
Yeah.
And so, as I read it, I thought that didn't fit in so well. It looked like a later author is inserting that to make her look like she deserved all this stuff. That was my personal reading. I don't know if that could be supported by anything. That's how I looked at it. But it's not in the LXX.
Right. And then when, after she's been gang raped, she is standing, sure, she's lying, she has fallen down at the door of the house, and her hands were upon the threshold. And the Levite comes out and says to her, up and let us be going. But none answered. Then the man took her upon an ass, and the man rose up and got him unto his place. She may not have been dead, but he simply carved her up.
And it's a horrible story.
It's a horrible story. And then when, after, you know, when there's this moment where everybody goes, oh crap, if we destroy Benjamin, we'll be the 11 tribes of Israel, and that sounds dumb. When they provided them with wives, what they did was actually, there was a point where there would be a bunch of young girls, young virgin girls, out just minding their own business, and they arranged for the Benjaminites to kidnap and rape them. And so once again, like there is no concept of female personhood and being a wife. One of the ways to become a wife is to be raped by someone and therefore be his property. So whatever this story is about, if you aren't seeing just how violent it is against women, and that these women may have been utterly innocent, the concubine's only sin may have been missing her parents.
Yeah, very well put. This is good for men. Well, even if you can call it good, it's absolutely horrible to women, to gays, and it's just too bad. And so, thanks, Holly. Holly is, she's really smart.
Yes.
I appreciate you adding that context. I didn't know if I'd have enough time to illuminate that, but thanks for doing that.
Yeah, thank you, Holly. And I don't want to downplay her comment at all in mine, but my interest in this story is the symbolism. And we see these women and the characters in the stories as being the nations, right? So it's not actually a woman being cut up and sent off. It's a nation that is split in pieces, right? So I was just wondering if, because I think you, you know, you mentioned the fact that we have a representation of the divine and the human, which the sex is, you know, symbolic of union between the divine and the human. And I wondered if you could kind of expound on that, because to me that's the real interesting part of what you're getting at here, is expound on the meanings behind these symbols.
You're talking about the angels and the humans, right?
Yeah, the representations of the nations and the... Have you gotten into that at all?
No, you probably... Do you have some insight, Cheryl?
Well, just I like what you said about the...
Well, okay, go ahead, and then I'll throw in...
Well, I really like what you said about the sex. You know, in the Bible, it represents union between the divine and humans, and we can see this in the stories. There's different types. I mean, relationships between humans and God are sometimes very... you know, messed up, or sometimes very loving, and so we see these kinds of things in scriptures.
And I see these divine beings come down at the Noah story, and they take women, and as Holly pointed out, and I think I agree that it was probably not the women's choice, but they generate a race of Nephilim, the ones who have fallen. It doesn't have good connotation.
Right, so the fruit of union between the divine and human. But I'd like to, you know, go one step farther as we recognize these patterns, and you know, we're still very literal in the way we're approaching these stories. I think we need to get to the next step on that.
Right. Yes.
Now, that was a perfect segue into my next comment/question/maybe provocative debate opening, whatever it ends up being. All right, you asked for it. Anyways, to me, it seems like part of the problem here, or part of the issue here, is that, you know, you're making the case for this being metaphorical, symbolic, more than, you know, literally happening as the text explains it. However, one of the issues that I see with that is the Bible doesn't, you know, you don't have any explanation that says, you know, this is a work of fiction, or this is symbolic, or this is to be taken metaphorically and allegorically. You know, like we do with, say, the parables of Jesus, you have him explaining later that, you know, these are stories I'm using to illustrate points. So my question is, and obviously the original versions of these stories have been lost to time and so forth. But originally, near as we can tell, would the ancient readers of this be taking these stories as literal or figurative? And as a follow-up to that, if they are meant to be taken figuratively, then why are they presented literally?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I think they probably read them literally, is my guess. I'm not an expert in that realm.
And then why do we believe this? Yeah.
But I believe they were originally oral traditions that had been passed down, and some of the stories, like the Noah story, appear to have come from earlier stories, Sumerian and Babylonian kind of flood stories, and the Epic of Gilgamesh, and some names I can't pronounce right now, so I won't try. But there's these earlier stories, and I think they were passed down through oral tradition, and at some point somebody put them down, penned them down, or chiseled them, or whatever they did back then, and scripted them. And then the author of all of the Noah and Sodom stories is Jay. The documentary hypothesis talks of multiple authors, and there's a number of authors, but these are all stories from Jay, the Yahwist, or the Jehovahist, and who has a... And I think they felt it was important to preserve these stories, but this is my own personal speculation. I think that Jay wanted to fashion them in a way to kind of parallelize them and make them all nice and neat and coherent. But I'm guessing they're different stories from different traditions that got pulled together. And I think they did read them literally and understood them literally. But today, I think we have tools to help us see that perhaps that's not the case. I've tried to illustrate that. You know, like, for example, the salt pillar formations at the Dead Sea, I don't think those are remnants of Lot's wife. But, it seems from a scientific modern understanding that that's probably not the case. It was probably an attempt to describe it. You look at the morality of God, and it says, well, Ham looked at Noah and saw him naked and didn't avert his eyes. Therefore, his son is cursed forever, and we have thousands and thousands of years of slavery because of that story. It seems to go against the grain of our modern moral sensibilities and what God should do. And so I argue that today we ought to understand it as non-literal, but I think they probably read them literally back then. I hope that answers your question.
It does enough.
Okay. It's the best I can do.
Wanted to ask you another question about the Nephilim. So you explained it with kind of the traditional Protestant way, with angels coming down and having sex with humans, creating giant babies or some such thing. I know that Joseph Fielding Smith tried to Mormonize the story by saying that the sons of God were people born in the covenant, and the daughters of men were people born outside of the covenant, and marrying outside of the church was so bad that God sent the flood. That was kind of Joseph Fielding Smith's version of the story. So with that perspective, have you come across like a Mormon version of who the Nephilim were, or how the church explains that?
And I'm sure somebody here knows better than I do. I really didn't look closely at the LDS text, but isn't it the Book of Moses? Don't they describe the Nephilim, or the sons of God, when they saw the daughters of men? I think they say they're Noah's sons.
Yeah.
That he sees these hot, women, and you're like, wow, we're American. I think that's...
I've written a blog post about that, too.
This year, he's a mic. Okay. Come on, it's Cindy.
So, I think I've written a blog post about everything in the Old Testament. But, we do have this very Mormon interpretation of the story. And I think that what he does with them is he, later church leaders tend to see these men of renown as priesthood holders. So we have the priesthood on the earth very early, and that's again from union with divine and human. But I don't think Joseph Fielding Smith, I think he saw the scriptures very literally.
Oh, yeah.
So yeah, but we do see these as, he thinks the Nephilim, maybe the giants is a little bit of a corruption, but definitely the priesthood there.
Yeah, in my take, and this is just me personally, but I think Joseph Smith, when he's reading the Old Testament and so forth, he wants to make God good according to his moral sensibilities, 19th century sensibilities. And so I think it's hard for him to conceive of these angels that coming down and capturing these women. It just kind of was too much of a stretch. So I think he kind of cleaned that up. And I think he does that in other places where, you know, God repented that he never made man, and Joseph Smith takes out the word repented, you know, because God can't repent, right? And so I think there's a little bit of that. But Jay is so earthy and fun to read, but really very foreign from our modern sensibilities. But yeah, when you're bored in sacrament meeting, open up Genesis and read especially Jay, and it's really fun. But makes you scratch your head.
So you had mentioned that you're actually interested in this because of the Sunday school lessons that you had been asked to teach. So I'm curious how you frame that to a Mormon audience, or how you framed that to a Mormon audience, or how you would propose that we go forth from this and frame it to a Mormon audience. Because what you talked about was great today, but it's going to kind of whoosh over some Mormons' heads, I think, maybe. So
this was my Sunday school lesson, but with a little enhancement and a little less... I did joke about the little blue pill that Abraham needed, and but it went over well. I was very careful not to go too far, but at some point, if you get the audience going, you can take a few liberties. But I did go through these parallels. I did go into the Judges 19 story, but it people came up. They really liked my lessons, so I maybe they'll ask me in four more years to teach it a third time in a row. It's the only one they ever ask me to teach them.
I just wanted to comment. I think it's interesting that we think that the Sodom and Gomorrah story is about homosexuality, because the Judges story, that's so important. If it's about anything, it's about gang rape, which is not equivalent with homosexuality. And so whether you're gang rape being a woman and judges, or you're threatening to gang rape men, like, it's interesting that that seems to me like a pretty obvious point that even the densest of us Mormons could understand.
And even if it's angels that you're...
Right, like, that gang rape is not the same as homosexuality.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good point. And by the way, if you want a very good take on Lot... Storyline. She gave an excellent presentation. Was it yesterday?
Yeah.
So it's worth looking up if you want another perspective.
Yeah.
Yes.
Slightly off topic, you mentioned Jay and the documentary hypothesis. Do you bring those kinds of things up in your Sunday school class? And if so, how does it go over?
I did in the first... My first one, which was, I think, 12 years ago. They don't ask me to teach often. I did. I actually assigned different readers. I had two different readers. And I would, and I did the parallels. And I mentioned it lightly in there. I don't know if you are familiar with David Bakavoy's book, which I think is on sale downstairs. It came out earlier this year. But he's a pioneer in introducing documentary hypothesis in modern biblical scholarship to an LDS audience, and he's my daughter's seminary teacher, so he's in this church department of education, but he's also able to preach these things that are new to LDS audiences, and in some ways maybe a little difficult to swallow from our traditional way of teaching, but I think it's an important step, and perhaps we're moving more to that. But that's a great book if you want anybody who wants to read about the documentary hypothesis. It's once you know about that, it's fascinating to read Genesis when you know about the different aftershocks. It just makes it so much fun to read.
Sorry, just piggybacking on the woman before, I made a side comment, and the gal next to me said, it'd be nice if we mentioned that every time, that gang rape has nothing more to do with homosexuality than it has to do with heterosexuality.
Right.
You know, so looking at the story from, you know, maybe in our dialogues as we bring up and we talk about the story, we can talk about both types of sexuality and how neither one of them is defined by that.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a very good point. Yeah, there's gang rape, and then they have to include angels almost having sex with the evil inhabitants of Sodom to parallel Noah having, you know, those people, the angels having sex with women. They have to have that in there to have the parallel. Yeah, so that's part of it.
Okay, so I would love us to get away from these literalist descriptions of the scriptural stories, right? Because they're obviously, when you see these strange little stories, they're so very strange because that's meant to point your mind to the fact that they're symbolic. So, you know, I mean, we don't have to, like, get all freaked out about gang rape because that's symbolic of something else, and think in your mind, what is that symbolic of? And by the way, I love the work of, what's her name?
Michelle,
I love her work. But that seems to me to go beyond really what the scripture is trying to point our minds to. So.
Exactly, yes.
I would argue that we have no idea. I mean, this is a question of authorial intent, and we don't exactly know. They may very well have been intended to be understood literally. It's entirely possible. And the fact of the matter is, it's pretty gross to use gang rape as a symbol for something.
Right.
It's a society that finds a way to make gang rape acceptable is pathological.
Well, that's why I didn't want to take away from what you were saying. You know, yeah, you're absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And so if we want to use, if we want to tell stories about, you know, deviating from, you know, the principles our foreparents used or whatever, or having division, a story in which it is okay for a father to take his virgin daughters and offer them to strangers, or a story in which a man would take his wife and let her be raped almost to death, if we try to rehabilitate that, we are perpetuating psychological violence, and it is really pretty uncool. Which isn't to say that I didn't love your presentation. It actually was awesome, and I learned a lot, and it was very instructive. But that story should be understood as a story of profound cruelty.
I hope my intent was to show these are non-literal, and that was my goal, and hopefully that lessens the horrific. I mean, we should take them as not real stories. That's kind of my goal. So hopefully that contributed to what you
said. Well, I would think that if the intent...
I would think that if the intent was to justify the destruction of the Ammonites and the Moabites and the Canaanites, I would think that authorial intent was for it to be read literally.
But, well, and interestingly, our own church just put out one of the essays that mentions Canaanite and says, and they don't, the way they phrase it, they don't take direct, and they say people in America have used that story to justify slavery. They didn't say we use that story to deny. But the point is, they're taking that out and stepping away, and that's good. And this is gradually seeping in.
I'm hesitant saying anything because I really do like your presentation. I do want to say, though, that kind of along with what she was saying, there is It is for me hard to go. They're just purely literal. I mean, they're purely symbolic, not literal, because someone chose those symbols, you know. And frankly, it's easier for me to think that they have a literal element because that's useful to us. You look at what's going on in the Congo today. You look at what's going, you know, like these things happen and are happening, and we can look to these stories to draw conclusions from them. I think the difficult thing from the story is holding up Lot as an innocent character, as the good guy in the story. I think the hard thing is holding up the concubine's husband. As you know, like I think there is something to looking at the stories and going, who's good, who's bad, what do we learn from it to help us with the issues today? Because these are literal things, and kind of saying the stories are purely figurative kind of says gang rape doesn't really happen. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, good point.
I think it's both. I think it's okay to take both approaches.
But I think they're using the literal part that happens in the world around them, right? And not to say that that doesn't happen, but also to just say that the point of the story is to point you to something else.
So thank you so much, everyone, for your participation in this discussion. It's been fantastic, and let's give Claire a round of applause.